Video computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for Q1 at 20K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. Today, we are speaking to Larry Schnaff. You've been doing a lot of legal research on the JFK records that are supposed to be released, and you just let me know that you have penned a letter early in February here, like people listening to Black Op Radio, to be on top of what you've been doing. And so I turn it over to you.
Okay. Hey, well, good evening. I hope everything's okay in Canada. As your listeners probably know, President Trump issued an executive order on January 23rd, which asked for a plan to declassify the remaining records remaining in the possession of the federal government relating to the assassinations of President Kennedy, Senator Robert F. Kennedy, and then, of course, Martin Luther King. There was some concerns about the letter, the order, because, you know, he could have simply said, I hereby instruct the National Archives to, you know, declassify all the records in its possession. He didn't do that. He asked for a plan, which has caused some concern amongst us because, you know, we had a plan that was prepared by the agencies just 2.5 years ago for President Biden that called for records to be withheld until at least the 2040s. So the idea that he was calling for another plan was a bit concerning. The other thing was it wasn't clear, you know, presidents don't write their executive orders, staff does, and it was unclear, to me at least, that people writing the orders for him, whether they were aware that the universe of JFK records is not limited to the records in the JFK collection. And so the executive order provides that the Director of National Intelligence and the Attorney General, along with the National Security Advisor, would submit a plan for review by the President and the President's and the White House Counsel. So I sent a letter to the White House Counsel. I have a mutual friend, and so I made sure that the letter actually landed on his desk for him to see, which basically let him know about the records that are not in the collection that should be searched for and disclosed. So for your listeners who may not be aware of all the details, when the Assassination Records Review Board shut down in September of 1998, they didn't close operations because their job was finished. They closed their operations because Congress said, that's all we're going to give you for money, for funding. And at the time they shut down, there were several outstanding searches for records that they had propounded on various agencies. For example, they had a bunch of records they were trying to seek from the CIA, asking them to search for these certain records. In fact, the ARB entered into a three-way agreement, which is called a Memorandum of Understanding, with the National Archives, with the CIA, and the ARB, where the National Archives would be responsible for supervising the CIA's compliance with this agreement, where they were going to continue to pursue the records that the ARP had asked for. Well, NARA never actually followed up on that order. So we have that category of records. At the time that the ARP went out of business, it was negotiating with the Robert F. Kennedy Family Trust for the records that Bobby Kennedy had taken from the White House, from the Oval Office, hours after the assassination, which many of us believe probably have stuff about Cuba in there, and the ARB was offering not to identify them as assassination records if they were, you know, handed over to the National Archives. That effort obviously stopped, and there's been no follow-up with that. The ARB had actually tried to get the records of Walter Sheridan, who was a right-hand man of Bobby Kennedy, who conducted some investigations for Bobby and also had worked for NBC to undermine the Garrison investigation. And the ARB asked for those records that were, Walter Sheridan had put them in the JFK library. The records instead of being sent to the ARB or the archives, were sent to NBC. And then the ARB actually sued the Walter Sheridan estate to try to get the records. And then NBC intervened and tried to claim that they were subject to the reporter's privilege. And then, of course, ARB went out of business and a lawsuit went away. So, and then we have the Carlos Marcello recording from the Camtex sting operation where he allegedly said to his cellmate, who was an FBI undercover agent, who was recording their conversations, he allegedly confessed that he was behind the assassination or behind the planning of it. And those tapes have never been heard, much less transcripts reviewed. The ARB had reviewed transcripts of an earlier sting operation against Carlos Marcello from, I think it was 1979-80. But these were later tapes of different type, and I think the ARB got confused between the two sting operations. And so these recordings should be unsealed. They were sealed by the court. So we were trying to let the White House counsel know that when the agencies come up with these plans or a plan to declassify the records, they can't be limited to the records that are just in the collection, because that does not represent the universe of records that pertain to the assassination. Now, I just read today that the FBI announced that it had found mysteriously or miraculously discovered 2,400 new records relating to the Kennedy assassination. So hopefully, you know, from my lawsuit against the National Archives a couple years ago, I learned that the National Security Council basically hijacked the process, and they were the ones that were tasked with evaluating compliance with the JFK Act during the Trump 1.0. And this time around, you know, President Trump fired 150 people that were staffers for the NSC, and he just obviously his administration offered early retirement for a bunch of CIA people. So we're hoping that maybe the people that are replacing these lifetime professionals, at least for this particular issue, that they're going to be there and try to satisfy and comply with the president's wishes, which were he determined that enough time has come and that all the records should be released, that it's in the public interest for the records to be released. Now, the Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King is much more complicated, because those records, most of the Bobby Kennedy records are LAPD and LA District Attorney records. There may be some federal records, but they're not subject to any particular statute like the JFK Records Act. But if they're in the possession of the federal government, President Trump would have the ability to declassify them. And then the same thing with the Martin Luther King files. There are files that, you know, are in the possession of the federal government in addition to those in Memphis. So I'm not particularly well-versed on the RFK or MLK records, and those are to be, the plan for those records are to be given to the White House 45 days after the order. So the order was January 23rd. This past Friday, the 7th, was the 15-day deadline for the John Kennedy records. So then the 30 days from February 7th, which I guess would be March 8th, that's probably when those records would be due, the plan for those records. So right now, all we have is a plan. Now, supposedly, a plan was submitted on Friday the 7th by the acting director of national intelligence. No one has seen
them. If you don't mind me, how do we know that? How do we know that much that they did do some paperwork?
Well, there was an article, WABC Radio wrote a piece on Friday. I know the reporter. The reporter's pretty diligent. So I think the reporter called up, you know, the office and to confirm whether the plan was actually sent. Again, I'm concerned about what this plan calls for, because just you know, 3 years ago or so, the transparency plans were approved by President Biden, and they provided for events when records could be reviewed again. And some of the events that they said would trigger reviews were non-statutory events. In other words, events that the statute did not require. For example, they would provide for records to be reviewed upon the death of a person that whose name was being, you know, redacted. Well, the statute doesn't say you wait until the person's dead. It says you have to show that revealing the person's name would present imminent harm to them. So they created these events which don't comply with the statute. So I was also trying to let the White House counsel know, because he clearly is not a subject matter expert on this, that whatever plans that are proposed, they have to comply with the statute. Because the reason Congress passed the statute was because the way that the executive branch was processing records under the FOIA, under the Freedom of Information Act, or under the executive order for handling classified records, was causing records not to be released. So Congress overrode those has specific criteria for which records could be released. So, and I also told in my letter, I said, if there are requests for postponement, in order to assure the American people that the process used is legitimate and that it truly poses a legitimate risk to national security, that there should be a independent committee formed of subject matter experts to review those postponements, much like the ARB did, because the process that was used, you know, during the Trump 1.0 and during the Biden administration, you know, the archivist actually objected to the grounds for postponement that the FBI and the CIA used in Trump 1.0. I have copies of memos that the archivist sent to the agency saying these requests are not consistent with the statute and they also don't conform to the interpretations of the ARB. And they were overruled by the National Security Council. And in fact, not only were they overruled, then they asked the archivist to write a letter, a memo to the president requesting postponement. So we need someone representing the public interest in the process of reviewing these records, because in the process used by the two past, by Trump 1.0 and by Biden, the National Security Council felt it was the public interest to prevent these records from being disclosed. And there was no, that's not what the test is.
Yeah,
the
let's think about that. It's against the public interest to reveal these, right? Imagine the
right,
poverty
would,
of that, you know?
Yeah, no, so their argument, then they have a very lame argument. They're saying, well, Mr. President, if we release the names of these people who served as informants for us in the 1960s, it's going to be difficult for us now to get new informants and undercover people in foreign countries, because if we promise we won't reveal their names, they're going to say, well, look, you disclose the names of these people from the 1960s. How can we trust you?
That's making a case for it, because the other side is we're going to have to reveal that all these agencies just bent over backwards to make sure there was never an honest investigation. And that's the
reaction. Right, but I'm saying that what Mike Pompeo said to President Trump and what the NSC clearly continued with the Biden administration was this was the argument they were making, and President Trump actually said 2 weeks ago on Hannity that when he was told this, he felt, well, you know, Mike Pompeo is a good guy and the people working for the NSC are, you know, they have the country's interests at heart, so I'm going to go defer to them. But those people that made those recommendations both in Biden's term and in Trump 1.0 are now gone. Trump fired them. So hopefully the people that are in there now are going to be more honest about the situation and not be so loyal to the agency, the CIA and the other agencies they work for. So, you know, so today's, you know, right off the press, we allegedly, the FBI found 2,400 new files that, which just shows you how the process is so, it just shows you how corrupt it is.
Yeah,
these records,
I don't know whether
these
to
records
believe
were
it.
Not found.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'll say that these records were not found during the review of the ARB during the Trump 1.0 and then during the Biden. It's because they knew that people weren't looking over their shoulders. They were had the protection of the NSC to guard to hide behind. And now that Trump has gotten rid of the protectors, I guess they're going to now have to hopefully reveal more records. But you know, we have the Donald Heath records, that the memo that they finally revealed his name after he died, and we learned that he wrote a memo to the House Select Assassinations Committee in 1977, and he disclosed to the committee that during the weekend of the assassination and in the next couple of months, the CIA actually conducted its own investigation of the Cuban exiles and the Cuban nationalists living in Miami, and that there were reports written, sent daily back to headquarters about the results of this investigation. We never knew about this. And Heath actually said the records are probably going to be in this guy's office. I think his name was McLean. And we have no evidence that they ever looked for them.
And then that will lead to somebody named George Joannides, who might have been in the thick of that. And then, of course, when it's become widely known by the public that he was a guy called out of retirement to handle this, to handle all the requests from Dan Hardway. And,
not only that, they also lied to the ARB about his role. So first he was brought out of retirement to basically manage that. That's a bureaucratic term of art to manage the HSCA to make sure it didn't go places where they didn't want it to. Then when the ARB was reviewing the records, they lied about who Joannides was. And just Tunheim was when he found out about this, he was livid.
Yeah, along with Blakey, right?
Yeah, yeah.
From the sidelines, researchers, you know, such as ourselves, we have a real discerning eye, crooked view of these things. So we're ready to find these guys that we know are lying, obfuscating, doing whatever. And those guys just kept going along with, you know, oh, they would never lie to us. They would never lie to us. And it says, do you know who this George Joannides is? I mean, there's that rare picture of him getting a medal.
That's, those guys came from a generation that were much more trusting of the government. But, you know, back in the early part of the 20th century, Justice Brandeis once said, sunshine is the best disinfectant. And the only way, and one of the reasons, you know, we've talked about this before, that that the Kennedy assassination isn't just a historical event. It's still the things that were done to hide the truth continue to affect the way policy is done now. If people working in the government, particularly in these secret letter agencies, know that no one's going to be seeing their memos and seeing their decisions, they get more arrogant and less, and they just, you know, they know that no one's going to be second guessing them. But if they knew that they're going to be eyeballs looking at their work product, they would be more careful, and they would make sure that they're more honest, because that's how the process is supposed to work.
Yeah, I know. And, I still can't get over that Americans allow Hillary Clinton to walk free after knowing that she had her own secret server, they had her own emails, and how many thousands of them just got erased. And I know, like, you know, Trump, love him or hate him, but, you know, he says, I'm not releasing my tax records, and Hillary can release her all those emails that she's not supposed to have. And, you know, the public just says, well, I guess we can't do anything, you know?
It's amazing when you brought that up, because that is a pervasive problem even in state level. When I was, you know, I work with regulators all the time. I represent developers, but I also, you know, I'm working with the environmental agencies. And when Andrew Cuomo came into governor in New York State, when people would leave the employment of the state, all their emails would be destroyed within 30 days. unless they specifically save them. And then even when you're generating records, I could be talking to, say, I'm just giving an example. I could be talking to someone that's working for the state, and maybe we have an email exchange where we have a little, like, personal pleasantries, and then we talk business, right? It's up to them to decide, is this a record that has to be preserved, or is this a record that's personal and that I could destroy? And what Hillary Clinton did was something that other people have done also, but the point was the whole purpose of that system was to create a parallel set of records that would not have to be produced under a FOIA request. So they went outside the public record system to create the separate server. And that's not the first time that was done. It was the most prominent time, but it just, there are so many ways that government officials and employees try to game the system so they don't produce records that have to be disclosed. And now you're seeing there's all these other apps, and I can't even tell you what the names are, that people communicate on to avoid emails and texts that could be discovered. It's really that the law has to be amended to reflect the modern times. But that also reminds me, even if all of the records that are in the collection are released in total, and if they complete these searches that are asked for and they are completed, there are still other records that the president is unable to require to be released under the statute. And the two most important ones are the deed of gifts and then the IRS tax records. And that would require an act of Congress, because right now the statute did not grant the president the authority to release the records of the IRS records of Oswald, for example, and other people. And it does not give him the authority to overrule deed of gifts. Deed of gifts are the things, for example, the ones that are most prominent right now, are the William Manchester notes that of Jackie Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. And those are subject to a deed of gift. And the ARB tried to get Carolyn Kennedy to turn them over, and she almost did it, but I was told by Judge Tunheim that she then went to her Uncle Ted, and her Uncle Ted told her, I don't think your mother would want this to be done, and so she said no. Those notes are not going to be released under the current structure until 2067. So there is a bill that Congressman David Schweikert has introduced again. He did this 2 years ago, but when he did it 2 years ago, the Democrats were in power. But he's now introduced a bill, and it would actually overrule the tax exemption and also overrule the deed of gifts. And that also, the deed of gifts would also include all the autopsy materials, too. I personally think that the Kennedy family never had the right to impose conditions on the autopsy materials, because those were actually, under traditional rules, the office that does the autopsy is a state, it would be subject to, the state would own the files. The coroner's office would actually have ownership of those, and not the Kennedy family. But that's a discussion for another day. So we're going to have to also try to get those other last few restrictions lifted to get the complete picture of the records that we know exist, that perhaps could add some, further insight onto what happened. So we're going to see the next couple of weeks, what the next thing is, we want to see what this plan, if the plan was in fact submitted, and WABC Radio is saying it is, and the fact that there was a report today that the FBI found more records suggests that there is a real effort underway to try to satisfy the president's request. And well, I guess we'll have to, just watch this carefully. Now, obviously, there's not going to be a smoking gun saying, here's how we killed the president. But there may be enough, hints that'll add, this is like a big mosaic or a big puzzle. And presumably the records that are released are going to help fill the gaps and complete the mosaic, the picture,
yeah,
what was going on.
I know what you're saying. It's like the Schrodinger's cat, right? There's documents, yes, in there, or there isn't, right? And so we don't know until you open
it.
And
right.
The other side of the coin is, though, I wonder if there's enough animosity going on that somebody like the FBI might have said, listen, we didn't plan it, and so we're gonna cover our butt here. We're gonna say, here are the people, you know, surrounded by Alan Dulles and you know, Bank of Boston and Sullivan Cromwell, whoever, who had enough money to put this into play. And they obviously must have, you know, asked professionals to get this thing rolling. And if they ended up hiring ex-Cubans and things, you know what I mean? Like, they may just say, here's the paperwork and where the investigation was going, you know. And at least it would be, it's not Lee Oswald. We looked into this stuff. He was a patsy. He had nothing to do with it. And he was there to take the blame. That's kind of what we already know. But it may just be that, because there's so many people that are still, these guys have got new shows popping up saying that Lee Oswald did it after all. We know it again. In fact, there was some report. They brought out Gerald Posner to talk about this documents release. As if he said, oh, these new documents are going to show, you know, to the nth degree how Lee Oswald all did it after all. I mean, it's just, I can't put it into words, the poverty of it.
Well, the weird thing is, everything is like, this is like Seinfeld Bizarre World, where everything's the opposite of what it should be. And in the old days, it was the Republicans who were protecting the deep state and on the grounds of national security. And now it's the Democrats who are protecting the bureaucrats and the CIA. And so it's the idea that if President Trump is ordering records to be released, then the immediate reaction of the Democrats is to find some reason to push back on it. And so, you know, I try to like just, I know the old Arab saying about the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And I always try to find, you know, even with people I disagree with, you always can find something you can agree on. And we were able to get JFK Facts, you know, Jeff Morley and I we have our weekly podcast. We were able to get a bipartisan letter sent to the president. Steve Cohen from Tennessee, he's a Democrat, and David Schweikert from Arizona, Republican, to write a letter to the president, basically asking for, you know, try to put some beef or flesh on the bones of his executive order. But to get a bipartisan letter in these days is like, you know, it's a minor miracle. So we're hoping maybe on this particular issue, and since it involves MLK, maybe we'll get some bipartisan effort. But there is a big effort in the media to poo-poo this stuff because, you know, the liberal media views this all as conspiracy theories now.
And well, it's dead. You know, I mean, with the fact of, Joe Rogan and, I don't know, Russell Brand, Tucker Carlson, so many other people doing important interviews that are worth listening to, whether you agree or disagree. You go, this is an honest investigation here. The guy's talking to the guy and the guest is going to speak. I mean, did you see, I hate to use that word poverty all the time, but did you see Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders grilling RFK Jr.? I mean, it was embarrassing.
The idea that Elizabeth Warren, who has the most contributions from the pharmaceutical industry, to be questioning him about suing her clients or her donors, I mean, that was the height. I mean, look, I was an elector for Bobby. I mean, I worked on his campaign. I was one of the electors for New York State. I was, you know, if you were in New York State, had he stayed in the race, you know, you'd have been voting for me. So, one of many. But that was embarrassing, and that was all performance, you know? I mean, that's all that was. It was performative.
Gutless. I mean, when he says to Bernie, he's like, no, he goes, I haven't taken $1. You've taken $1.5 million. And he goes, oh, out of 200, though, only out of 200 million, that $1.5 million. And it's like, you're not
kidding. Went further than that. He said, oh, no, those are workers for the pharmaceutical companies, which is not the way it works. The fact that an individual gives money to Bernie, that's not going to be identified as a contribution from their employer.
Yeah, it is sickening. And I think that if there is any backlash to this that is going in Trump's favor, and, you know, anytime I mention anything positive, I go, well, you know, I like what this USAID expose has been going on. I mean, it's stuff that we've thought forever, and now it's coming out, and people are just screaming from the rafters, you know, we've got to stop this, we've got to stop this. I can't believe the psyche of some Americans that just that like Bernie and like Elizabeth Warren, that you go, you're turning the world upside down.
Yeah, they don't even realize that USAID was used for so many years as to CIA covert operations. And I'm not even sure. I mean, the idea that I have plenty of friends that, first of all, when you talk about reputable people, when I post anything about Tucker Carlson, I have my liberal friends who will say, how could you, I can't believe you think he's a credible person. And I said, I'm sharing what he wrote and the things that he said. I said, the things I'm sharing, there is multiple sources that I have for my lawsuit. Some of the things he's saying I can actually verify. I can't verify everything, but when he said that Mike Pompeo, you know, convinced the president to not release the records, I can see that the CIA director was, they said they were going to go to the president. So, you know, but people are in their silos now. And yes, you know, I try to tell my friends, even a broken clock is right twice a day. So the fact you don't like President Trump, there are things he's doing, you know, there are some things he's doing that are good. And what are we doing? We're doing an audit of the agencies to try to find out what money they're spending.
Yeah,
I know we're going off.
The exposés was groundbreaking. It's just unbelievable, yeah. The stuff that's coming up. The funding for the whole Ukraine thing in 2013, 2014, Victoria Nuland. I mean, is it just the funding left over right of if you listen to some, you know, if you read and look into it, right? It's just unbelievable.
That's what Biden did. Biden funneled all that money through the USAID as a way to hide it. And we know that we have lots of CIA stations in eastern Ukraine. This is more about weakening Putin than anything else. But the stuff that's coming out is revelatory. And there was a hearing last week about DOGE. And, you know, Congress people were saying when they've asked for records that they can't, that the agencies can't even give them, like, a book with line items. They don't have it. And Musk is going in with his computer guys, and they're trying to figure out where the money's going. I have no problem with that. Now, you know, Trump is a developer, so he tends to go look at things like with a bulldozer. And, you know, the proper way to do things is you have someone like Musk who's given authority by the president to go do an audit, and then the way you would normally do it would be then Musk would then report back to the president the results, and the president would then tell the various agencies to fix the problem. That's a cumbersome process. That's the way it would normally be done. But they're not, you know, they're doing a different way now. And this is all about, there is a concept under the Constitution known as the unitary executive theory. And this was pushed during the Reagan administration. Congress can create departments in the executive branch. And the argument has been, well, then if Congress directs the executive branch head to do something, the president has no authority to do anything about that. And starting in the Reagan administration, they started coming up with this theory about, it's called the unitary executive, that the president as head of the executive branch has complete control over the departments. And so what we're seeing now is going to be a number of lawsuits that go to the Supreme Court that are going to try to define the scope of the power of the president. But what we're doing now is simply revisiting what happened in the 1930s with FDR. FDR came in and drastically expanded the power of the federal government. And there were all kinds of you know, contention in those days from conservatives about, you know, FDR expanding the federal government. And FDR won after he threatened to expand the court. And we're starting now to revisit a lot of these arguments. And the idea that the current structure has been in here since the founding of the country is wrong. It's just, you know, we're revisiting issues that we addressed 90 years ago. And so, you know, whether the president has the power to fire people that are commissioners on independent commissions, it all depends on the statute. Some statutes just say a commissioner can be appointed for a term, let's say 5 years. It doesn't mean that person can't be fired during that 5-year period. It just means they have the maximum they could serve is 5 years. But some statutes say the president can only fire them for cause, and others don't say anything. So I think that there's going to be a lawsuit one of these lawsuits is going to go to the Supreme Court this term or next term, and they're going to say that Congress actually creating a commission saying the president can't fire a person for cause, only for cause, they're going to say that violates separation of powers. There's going to be a lot of interesting constitutional developments coming out of this. And that's why they're flooding the zone, this administration. They're actually pushing to get a lot of these issues go up to the Supreme Court to get resolved. So, but hopefully, the unfortunate thing is, because of this large view of the president, you know, we were unable to proceed against Biden. Biden got dismissed from our case, the Mary Farrell case. And interestingly enough, Trump just replaced the head of the federal unit in the Department of Justice, and that's the unit that defends the president. And so I'm wondering if their litigation tactics and strategy are going to change now in our Mary Farrell lawsuit, but we won't know that for a while.
Well, it was also troubling that Biden pardoned so many of his family and Fauci and just, you know, anybody that you thought, like, how crooked is this that there hasn't even been any charges or a case, and he's pardoning them preemptively?
Yes. Yeah, that was very troublesome. And, you know, if you're a Democrat, that takes away the moral authority you have to argue about the things that Trump is doing. But the president's, you know, pardon power has always been, look, you know, Clinton pardoned a bunch of people that, you know, Mark Rich, and, you know, so it's always been a questionable, it's something that it's a relic of the days when, you know, we were, this is not, goes back to the time of the British with the king. You know, the king had certain powers and the president was given certain powers that the kings had. So, but right, Article 1 is Congress. Article 2 is the presidency. Then Congress, the founders always thought that Congress would be the principal, you know, governing branch of our country. And one of the problems that we're having in this country is that the political parties, you know, Washington warned about the political parties, and the political parties have essentially merged or blurred the distinction between the different branches. So when you have the same party that holds the presidency and the Congress, the founding fathers thought that each branch would jealously guard their prerogatives, and so Congress would make sure that the president doesn't intrude on their, you know, on their turf. But what's happened in the last 50 years or so is that it's the party, and so the party is the one that's going to dictate what happens. And I tried to get an oversight hearing in Congress in 22 after Biden postponed the records the first time. I tried to get a hearing through the Oversight Committee. My congressperson was the chair of the committee, and they would not hold a hearing because it could embarrass the president before the midterms. And so we never had a hearing. By the way, the archivist was just fired by the president. Now, I believe the archivist was fired because of the business with the Mar-a-Lago records. But I'm going to try, I believe the Oversight Committee is the one that confirms the archivist. And that's another opportunity we have potentially behind the scenes inside baseball to maybe get the archivist to make some commitments. I'd like to see the Schweikert bill be amended to expressly give the archives the power that the ARB had to make the declassification decisions. Because right now they can't make those decisions. They make recommendations, but the agencies that have the equities in those records are the ultimate arbiter or the president. And I guess we'll have to see how things play out with this plan. But I'm really concerned this plan is going to be a watered-down version of the transparency plans.
Well, I guess we wait and see. And, you know, thank you for your plans.
I'll let you know, and we'll, you know, we can talk about it again.
Yeah, yeah, very good.
But I want to thank you for all the work you're doing, because you're keeping this, you know, you're keeping this
in the news
out there. Yeah. And we got to put as much pressure. You know, we've been trying to tell. I know people that are very close to the president, and I, you know, have told them, you got to tell the president he can't let the CIA play him again this time. You got to feed his ego, right? You know, and when he went around telling people telling Judge Napolitano in, I think it was 2020, when he said, Mr. President, why did you postpone the records? And he said to him, well, if you saw what I saw, you know why I did that. Well, that was just covering for the fact that he got played by the CIA. Because I saw in my lawsuit, I got thousands of pages that were disclosed in my lawsuit. And I can see the president never saw any of the records. You know, they went to him and said, Mr. President, here's a list of records. We think these should be postponed because blah, blah, blah. And he goes, okay. I mean, I'm giving you a, you know, snarky.
Yeah, yeah.
but basically he wasn't reviewing the files. He didn't look at the files. There's no evidence he was. In fact, when he went on Twitter in October of 2017, right before the deadline was to, I think it was the 26th of October.
Yeah, he went
on
Thursday night and it was supposed to come out Friday morning.
Right. And it turns out that when he went on Twitter, what my lawsuit revealed was that there was already an executive order being version 12 of an executive order had been circulated amongst the CIA, the NSC, the FBI, the Department of Defense, and NARA. So he had no idea that this was going on. The deep state had just, you know, decided they were going to postpone the records.
Right.
And then they told him why he had to do it.
Yeah. He had 4 years off now, and he had all that kickback from all these different agencies, justice and that. So now he could be looking with a little more vindictive and, you know, a slanted eye. You got away with it before. You're not going to this time. Now, I mean, who knows? You know, anytime.
Well, I'm hoping that he's going to be less so that he, you know, it's the thing that happened to Kennedy. Kennedy trusted the CIA with the Bay of Pigs, and that taught him a lesson. And I'm hoping that what happened the last 4 years teaches Trump the same kind of lesson that Kennedy got, which was you can't trust these people and you have to use your own independent judgment. And so what we're trying to do now through all the contacts we have is to try to get the president to steal his back. And when the order comes, when the plan comes in and says, Mr. President, these records have to be postponed, that he's going to say, no, I told you I want a plan to release all the records. And that's what I want to do. Now, whether it's like, if the plan is like, more like procedural. Okay, well, this document is going to be reviewed by this office, and then this is how it's going to happen. That's one thing. But if it's like, well, this has to be reviewed by this person, and then this person, and then this person before we can release it, that's a problem, because the reviewing, that means they're going to try to keep hiding things.
And bringing Gerald Posner out to talk about it. I mean, that was just sickening.
I don't know how he got involved in that press conference. That's something that I'll have to ask Jeff, but he's the go-to guy. I mean, you know, the mainstream media, you know, you and I talked long ago how Alec Baldwin talked at the mock trial dinner. You know, I got him when we were just talking casually. I was asking him how come, you know, Chris Matthews and what's her name, you know, always support the Warren Commission. And he told me, he says, that's because it's a policy at Embassy Network to support the Warren Commission. I said, could you please say that in public? He says, sure. And, you know, that was revelatory that we all suspected it, but it came out. And he said, he was told this when he tried to put a program on in 2013. He had a week Friday night program on NBC. And he tried to do a 50th anniversary. He's going to have Bobby Kennedy on, a couple other people. And at the last minute, his program was pulled. And he was told by a senior producer, it's the policy of the NBC network to support the Warren Commission.
Well, thanks to the revelations from Elon Musk that what's really going on with USAID, it's unbelievable.
Yep.
All the money funding all these campaigns to discredit people and have web censorship. And
yep, I have Jesse Waters on, and I can see that he's just now announcing about the JFK 2400 secret JFK files that were never seen before.
Yeah.
I'd like to know.
Yeah,
I'd like to know where these files were kept.
Yeah,
because allegedly Hoover's files were all destroyed. So, you know, he had his own separate file, right? And allegedly his files were all destroyed. So where were these files, and why were they not discovered the first time? You know, and you know, Jeff Morley, he had an article a couple months ago about this whistleblower that said he had seen records in a in a warehouse somewhere in Virginia, a CIA warehouse, and the record's never been disclosed before, but he was afraid of identifying himself because, you know, identifying the presence of classified records could result in conviction, in a lawsuit.
Seth Rich. Right?
Yeah, you know. So, well, that's what they did, you know, in the Warren Commission. They would tell, they would take the testimony of witnesses, the 302s would be written up, the FBI 302 forms, and then it would be different than what the witness said. A witness would say, oh, this is not what I said. Then they would say, well, if you're lying, you know, lying to a federal officer is a felony. So it would put them in a perjury trap. So they try to say, well, you lied to, you're lying to us now because this is what the officer said you said. And now you're telling a different story. And if you are continue to say the story, you know, you can be subject to a felony.
And it's already printed. It's already in the volumes, you know.
So. Yes. So, you know, the FBI agent writes the, you know, writes his own version of what the person said. And then when a person tries to correct it, now they're being accused of lying to the FBI. So that was a purge. They put them on a purgy trap. But this is the game they play. Just like with some of the, now, again, I'm all for full disclosure. And I'm also want criminals to go to jail. But I know there were people that, a lot of people were upcharged like on January 6th that got a lot worse sentencing than similar situations or other types of crimes, trespass crimes elsewhere. And so, you know, there were some people that legitimately needed to go to jail. There are people that they were trying to make a point and they upcharged these people, just people wandering around. So,
I mean, when you look into it, it's really bad. It's really bad. At arm's length, you think, oh, well, there was an insurrection. And then they go, okay, let's just see what really happened. And you go, there was 200 plus FBI assets there dressed as MAGA supporters, agent provocateurs, you know, taunting and you know, I mean, we don't have to get into all that. But yeah.
Well, I was embarrassed as a New York lawyer for what happened with the two lawsuits against President Trump, because I mean, in the one case, you know, the banks did their due diligence, and every real estate developer does their own appraisals, and there was no victim. The banks got paid off, but Letitia James had campaign on getting Trump, and they trumped up these charges against him. And then the other one, well, I don't want to get any other one because I'm going to get in trouble.
No problem.
But anyway, the point is that, you know, people saw what they were doing. They were trying to use the legal system as a tool. And this is as bad. This is the kind of stuff that happens happened in the Soviet Union. You know, we always ask my friends, why did we fight a Cold War if, you know, with these kinds of the Democrats are, you know, using these practices that you would expect to see in a Soviet Union, these fake trials and cult cancer culture, and you can't say things and getting people to rat on each other. It was unbelievable. Anyway, sure this is going to make a lot of your listeners unhappy. But
tough luck. There's a lot of other more wild political shows than this. We're here just talking about what's new in the JFK community of research and opinion and that. And like I said, Trump, love him or hate him, but if you say anything positive, I agree with what he's doing there, people are just freaking out.
Right. That's the difficulty. That you can't – I mean, I have friends that kept saying, he's never going to issue the order. He's never going to issue the order. And then day one, what happened to the order? I said, you know, it's not the most important thing on the top of his list right now. I said, give it some time. He did it on day three. Then they said, well, nothing's ever going to happen out of it. He doesn't mean it. And then supposedly we have a plan, so we'll see. And now we have the 2,400 records. So every time that they said, it's because they think, they keep saying, the man is a liar. I said, okay, he may have done a lot of bad things.
I mean, can you believe this? Those 51 intelligence agency heads all signed a letter saying that the Hunter Biden laptop was You know, they signed it and they said it's disinformation, Russian disinformation, and they knew it wasn't. And the funny thing is when Trump's in, he revokes their security clearances. And that's where I go, good for him. These guys are all liars.
Exactly. These guys, the whole intelligence community, they reinforce each other. And this is the way Trump is coming in with the bulldozer. He's breaking up the system that has entrenched lies, lied to the American public, manipulated our foreign policy since Kennedy's assassination. And he's breaking it down. And to that extent, I agree with what he's doing. It doesn't mean I agree with everything else.
Right, and it doesn't have to mean that you're pro-Trump or called me something that, you know, a Trump supporter. It's like, I'm Canadian. What are you talking about? And I must have said this about 100 times, but if I was going to vote for anybody, I would have voted for RFK Jr. I mean, I just liked him, you know, with his flaws. Compared to Biden, compared to Kamala, compared now to Elizabeth Warren and Bernie and these, anyway, it's another topic.
Let me tell you, I was a volunteer on Bobby's campaign in New York. I was one of the captains, whatever. And when I saw what they did to him, the Democratic Party, first, they made it almost impossible for him to run in the primary. And what they did was they told any consultant that worked with any candidate who challenged President Biden in a primary would never work again for the Democratic Party. So that's how they got people not to run, because they knew they would be forever, you know, these people make a living.
Ostracized.
Consulting, right? And they were told they were never going to work for the Democratic Party again if they supported anyone that can't primary Biden. And then he decides he has to go and be his independent. And the stuff they did to keep him off the ballot, I mean, I've been working with presidential campaigns since 1972 on McGovern's campaign, and I have seen a lot of stuff. I was shocked at the amount of money, the campaign that they did to bringing up stuff that, you know, from years ago to try to taint Bobby. And I will tell you, I think Trump won because Bobby endorsed him. I think the difference in the popular vote and in the key swing states was the people, the 4 or 5% at the end, who were supporting Bobby. And I kept telling my friends, Trump made a promise to Bobby that he was going to release the records, and he's going to do it. And everything he's done so far, is that he seems to be consistent with what he said he was going to do.
Well, but yeah, more no, optimistic it was than Biden, right? Biden just clamped down and said, "We're not even going to open this." You know, he put a lock on that cupboard.
Well, my belief is that he never actually signed the executive orders that were issued under his name. I think the NSC, the National Security Council, was in charge of the process of declassifying the records. They had lawyers from the Department of Justice draft up the executive order, and they probably just put the president's signature on the order and told him that he was doing this. He probably said, "Is this complying with the law?" And they said, "Yes." I mean, I don't think the man had any significant role in the decision about the records. Unlike Trump, who said, you know, at the last minute, you know, said, "Okay." I mean, he was involved. I think Trump. I think Biden wasn't running his government. You know, we don't know who was running his government, but he wasn't.
Yeah. I don't know. I saw something that I can't trust, but it was a lip reading at the inaugural or whatever like that. And Trump is sitting beside Obama, and he said, "Were you really running everything?" You know, so it's it might not be a true lip reading, but it was kind of humorous.
Well, look, you know, even James Carville the other day said that Kamala was the seventh string quarterback. You know, so they just, you know, we can go on forever about what's wrong. But we have an ally on this particular issue about the JFK records. We have, it looks like, an ally in the White House, and we have people around him you know, the Roger Stones of the world and other people that are in his ear. You know, Roger Stone once told me that when he first talked to President Trump about the records, President Trump said, "And why should I be concerned about this?"
Well, you know, those who don't know anything about it, right? But
right. And Roger Stone educated him. Again, I'm not saying I believe everything Roger Stone says. I'm just saying I know him. He told me some things, and I'm just sharing what he said, you know. And it doesn't mean that, you know, I'm a Roger Stone supporter. I'm just saying I have friends across the political spectrum, and I use my contacts in any way I can to get this particular mission accomplished. And when Roger Stone had dinner with the president the other night, I asked him, please tell the president that there's holes in his order that could be exploited by the CIA. He said, I will do that.
Very good. Is the letter that you've written, is it public now?
You could post it if you want.
Okay, I'll post it along with the show notes for our interview here there.
Yep.
So people can
it's
see
it. It's sitting on it. It was sitting on the desk of David Warrington last Wednesday, so.
Right. I just want to be clear and check with you before.
That's fine. No, I think the more people see it, you know, and we're also, I think I mentioned to you, you know, last week was a tough week, but we were trying to get people to call up their Congress people and ask them. Schweikert and Cohen wrote this letter to the president, and they want to put some substance on the plan. It may be getting late, but it's not late yet. They wrote a Dear Colleague letter to each of their colleagues in the House of Representatives. And that's what they call it, a Dear Colleague letter, asking each of the representatives to sign on to this letter, the Cohen, Schweikert, JFK declassification letter. And we asked on JFK podcast and also on Project JFK, and then I posted something on the Education Forum, please call your representative, ask them to sign the Cohen Schweikert Dear Colleague letter about the JFK records. And if they could, you know, if your listeners could call up their representative and just leave that message, they can call either in Washington, D.C. or in their district office and tell them that you're a constituent, this is important to you, and you please have your representative sign this Cohen Schweikert Dear Colleague letter about the JFK records. They don't have to explain what it is. They'll just take the notes and then they'll relay the message. If we can get more people in Congress to start, you know, signing this letter, we may be able to get a better plan than what the CIA is going to probably propose.
All right, Mr. Schnaff, thank you so much for your efforts so far, and keep in touch with me. And any news, I'll be glad to have you on to discuss.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Okay, good
night. Okay, bye.
You're listening to Black Op Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. In this segment, we are speaking to reporter, author, Ray McGinnis. Hello, Ray.
Hey, Len. Good to speak with you.
Thank you so much for taking time to talk to me. I know that we talk mostly about Canadian politics. Of course, you wrote about American politics, and it's always in the news. People follow that. But it's always good of interest, and I know a lot of major news, they don't carry any of this stuff at all. And you have to be connected to somebody that will email and forward you some items of note. And I get that from you and other people that said, have you seen this? Have you seen that? And then I go, no, I didn't hear a word about it. So that's why I'm glad to have you on.
Well, we always have a little news that seems to be off the radar for the mainstream media. So if they take the story on, they offer up cherry-picked slanted reporting. So I'll try and give you something more like Dragnet did. Just the facts, man, the facts.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so a couple of things. So the first one has to do with the Trudeau. We're coming up to the third year anniversary of the Trudeau government in Ottawa's decision to invoke the Emergencies Act in response to the Freedom Convoy peaceful protest in Ottawa, where no windows were broken, nobody was socked in the jaw, and so on. And in there was a lawsuit, a civil suit, I think, which where there were a number of different, what do I call them? I guess they're called litigants, I guess, or people who have standing for this case, which includes the Canadian Constitution Foundation and also a man named Eddie Cornell, who was a Canadian Armed Forces veteran, and Vince Gersies, who's a retired police officer. Those two gentlemen both had, after the Emergencies Act was invoked on February 14th, 2022, they both suddenly found themselves randomly and arbitrarily had their bank accounts frozen, all their, they had no use of their credit cards, bank cards, and so on. And so they also had standing. And so the decision by Justice Mosley, Richard Mosley, in January 2024, which was a landmark decision, was to say that the government, the federal government of Canada, had acted unconstitutionally and illegally. The finding by the lower federal court was that there was no national emergency, no threat to the security of Canada, there are legal requirements built into the Emergencies Act to prevent it from being abused. There are four triggers named in the Emergencies Act legislation of 1988, which are, a government needs to have solid and compelling evidence that there is espionage or sabotage or serious violence that cannot be managed by the police or the army, or plot to overthrow the government. The Canadian Security Intelligence Services concluded that none of the four triggers were the thresholds have been met. This was also the estimate of the RCMP, which did not request the government invoke the Emergencies Act, and was also the conclusion of the Ontario Provincial Police. I think it was that group that on the day of the 14th of February 2022 had said that the protests were a peaceful, family-friendly event, not a threat to a passerby, unquote. And so the Justice Mosley decision, he found that the orders to freeze bank accounts violated the constitutional right to be secure against unreasonable searches and seizures, and that the restrictions on protests violated the right to freedom of expression. One of our charter rights, such as they are in Canada in 2025, is that we have the right to public assembly, to protest whatever public policy a government may choose to pass or choose to say they're planning to pass. So, one thing I'll add too, with regard to the freezing bank accounts, the lower court found that the governments, like the police, just arbitrarily on an ad hoc basis chose the several hundreds of people to freeze bank accounts for. Including people who worked as grocery clerks that maybe had $400 to their name in their bank account. It was just all over the map. And so there was no rhyme nor reason to why this person or that person, including people who were not even in Ottawa, who got their bank accounts frozen. So the decision by the lower court in January of 2024 was a blow to the Trudeau government. And the government announced, Justice Richard Mosley released his report, and within minutes of the release of the nearly 200-page decision, the government said, we're going to appeal. They hadn't read the report at that point. but they were determined that I guess the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau doesn't want to be to have a stain on his record that he acted illegally and unconstitutionally, or that he's suggesting that he's a tyrant. And so the government has spent over $2.5 million fighting, this whole case and appealed it. And they had a battery of their own government lawyers. And then I think that they found at some point as they got into the appeal, preparation, that their team of government lawyers didn't have, much of a case for, to pursue an appeal vigorously, that they would lose. And so the government went ahead and hired a private firm of lawyers to take on, to represent the government. And all of this, of course, is being the bill for all of this is being footed by Canadian taxpayers. And the private sector lawyers have higher hourly rates than even the government lawyers. So we had a 3-judge panel in Toronto on the 4th and 5th of February of this month hear the appeal. And the defense, the people affected by this, by the government's action, wanted the appeal to be dismissed because the definition of threats of security of Canada were not met, and that the CSIS director had informed the government that the definition of the threat to the security of Canada was not met. And the cabinet, the Liberal cabinet, failed to wait for an alternative assessment of the facts before invoking the act. I mean, they had the assessment by the Canadian Security and Intelligence Service that there was no threat. That was also what the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, were also telling them. And the government kept kind of saying, oh, well, the law should always defer to a government, to cabinet, in their decision making to invoke the act. So, what the government's position is basically is that we in 2022 and any government in the future that believes that a threat has been met, regardless of having contrary advice from the RCMP and the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, CSIS, can just go ahead and invoke an act in the recent past or in the future, because it just feels that there's a threat. That what the government wants is for the cabinet to have an unfettered discretion in invoking the Emergencies Act in the past, in the recent past, and in the future. The actual text of the Emergencies Act is to provide that there's some proper guardrails on the legislation so it can't be abused like this. And what came out in the 2-day 4th and 5th of February deliberations was the government really acted. Kind of their impetus to go ahead and invoke the Emergencies Act was in part because of pressure by the United States Biden administration, the Biden White House, which wanted the border blockades, like especially at the Windsor-Detroit Bridge, the Ambassador Bridge, to be resolved, which, by the way, it was by the night of the 13th of February, but never mind. And then the other is that they had, quote, speculation, they were speculating and also had suspicions that there might be a threat. So, as Natalie Duran, who was one of at the time, she was the deputy clerk of the Privy Council, which advises the Prime Minister about these things. She was one of the people who testified at the Public Order Emergency Commission hearing, 6-week hearings in the fall of 2022. And she said, well, a threat can mean many different things, and that we had to go ahead and say that the emergency was happening, because if we'd waited any longer, emergency might have come, you know, might have come along and presented itself. So you know, why wait for a real emergency to happen? Just go ahead and declare it preemptively, and that'll settle things. So the government's appeal, I think their presentation to the three judge panel was very weak. Now we'll find out. I mean, it's been pointed out to me that the sitting government since 2015 under Justin Trudeau has appointed over 850 judge appointments, and there's only about 960 judges in the whole country. So not that every time a government appoints a judge that person is partisan or compromised, but we have had a lot of unusual decisions in the last 5 years in Canada, where judges take judicial notice and assume that a provincial health officer's say so, or the government's insistence that such and such is the case is good enough for them, and nothing needs to be looked at beyond assurances from people in charge. But hopefully in this appeals court review, there'll be an impartial and vigorous review of what the defense has put forward, as well as the government.
Well, it does seem like a waste of money and a waste of time.
One of the things that it highlights is that, you know, we have a prime minister who's kind of like exit stage right or left, and doing it in a slow motion, because he's saying I'm resigning, but I'm taking my time, and you know, he's not known for being a constitutional scholar, and it seems that his you know, even the decision of the government to appeal the lower court decision, you know, shows a certain willful blindness to what the law properly should communicate to a sitting government and to people in the judicial system. Normally what happens, if a decision by a lower court, a federal court, happens where a government is being rebuked for their leadership, their actions, normally what happens is a government will receive the judgment by a judge, take their time to look it over several months, and then they may or may not decide to appeal. But this government, I saw, you know, Deputy Minister, Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland at the time speaking to the press and, you know, immediately stating, well, oh no, we're going to appeal this. I mean, she certainly wouldn't have read the report. So it seems that what is happening is that we currently are governed by a government whose reflexive action is always to double down and triple down on whatever their story is, their narrative, and they're not really interested in. You know, and I want to add, there's an irony, because the prime minister's father was Pierre Elliott Trudeau. And when Trudeau Sr. was prime minister, he invoked the War Measures Act to suspend basic civil rights and liberties in the wake of the Front de Liberation de Quebec, FLQ, crisis in October of 1970. And you know, that crisis involved bombings and kidnapping of several politicians and the murder of one. But even then, there was you know overreach by policing authorities. They infiltrated FLQ cell groups, which I don't object to. But over time, as the dispirited FLQ members left their cell groups, they had some FLQ cell groups that soldiered on that now were peopled entirely by undercover RCMP officers that kept writing scary press releases for the people of Quebec to get nervous about, and they burned a barn and a number of other things like that. And so as a result of that, and as a result of a four-year McDonald Commission from 1977 to 1981 to investigate government and policing overreach during the FLQ crisis, we ended up with the Emergencies Act in 1988. So it's great irony that we have the father of the current prime minister going, you know, too far, you know, in hindsight with what with the War Measures Act, and then successive governments in Canada go to an effort to put guardrails on this kind of, you know, biggest hammer in the toolkit of that a government can bring out. And then we find that the former prime minister's now sitting son, Justin Trudeau, ends up also overreaching and doing things unconstitutionally.
Well, what do you think the outcome will be?
Well, I am cautiously optimistic that when the Court of Appeal renders its judgment, which probably will be in late August or September of this year, that they will concur with the lower court. I mean, the lower court decision was very thorough. So I'm not aware of anything that the team representing the government brought to the 2-day hearings recently that is compelling to overturn the wisdom of that lower court decision.
Yeah, well, it's strange. I mean, the thing that pissed me off was just hearing that people's bank accounts got frozen and that the prime minister is saying, oh, there's Nazis, right? And, you know, nothing could be further than the truth.
Yeah, let me add one more thing, that when the federal court makes its ruling in late August, early September of this year, whatever its decision is, that will have an impact on a civil case which is, I gather, called tort as opposed to a class action, where there are 20 people, including Eddie Cornell, the Canadian Armed Forces officer, and Vincent Guercy's, the police officer, who both had their bank accounts frozen, and 18 others, who are seeking to sue the government for damages. And it's in the some millions of dollars, I don't know how many, but they're more trying, they have to sue for some amount of money, but they're wanting to take the government to court and, you know, sue individuals like the prime minister in order so that this kind of thing never happens again. But they have to wait for their civil case to go forward based on the decision of the federal appeals court. So it's a number of things that are kind of being, you know, delayed because of these kinds of decisions. But it's all part of a bigger chess game, which has incredible consequences for Canadian people, because if the federal appeals court rules that the government was in its right, then that will mean in the future that anytime a government feels, with, you know, in quotes, F-E-E-L-S, feels that there is a threat, regardless of whether or not you can make a compelling case that the triggers for invoking the Emergencies Act have been met, as long as the government feels that, it'll take the discretion to say, we think there's a threat, and off they'll go. Then they can freeze bank accounts, and they could do more than that. They could decide to just walk in and change the locks on the door of someone's home and say, this is ours now. Off you go. And you know, so there's really quite a lot of things that a government in the future, if the Court of Appeals goes with the government, there's no end to what could happen, because I mean, we had the Emergencies Act for 9 days, but once an Emergencies Act is invoked, government can make legislation without parliament sitting. They can write up new stuff, and it can be as draconian as you want. And there is no, there's very few remedies for putting the horse back in the barn.
Well, it's of interest. So thanks for just keeping me up to date on what's going on.
You're welcome. So there's also been in Canada a recent report that was released in the province of Alberta. It's called Alberta's COVID-19 Pandemic Response. Written by the Alberta COVID-19 Pandemic Data Review Task Force. And their report was delivered to the Premier formally, or at least publicly, in January of 2025. It's headed by Dr. Gary Davidson, who is an emergency physician at the Red Deer Regional Hospital for over 16 years and clinical lead of emergency medicine and so on, and chief of emergency department at the Red Deer Regional Hospital, and a number of other people, with all kinds of degrees and histories behind them, working in Dr. Justin Chin, emergency medicine specialist working full time at the University of Alberta Emergency Department since 2013, and so on, and what these people did. Oh, it also included Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, who was professor of medicine at Stanford University, who your listeners in the States will know as one of the people who championed the Great Barrington Declaration to get people to be not do the lockdowns, but just keep people who are vulnerable populations safe and have a protocol around that, as opposed to locking every school and business and so on. So in this report, the task force had to discuss governance and flow of information. They pointed out that Alberta, like all the provinces of Canada, had long-standing protocols for emergency response to any pandemic. And these go back to, I think, the 1950s, five decades at least. And they were always, great binders of all the things to do to respond step by step to a pandemic. And one of the things is to, in those protocols of long standing, was to respond to a pandemic by providing calm to the public, to not using fear to get people into hysteria, which is what we witnessed, to have the least possible impact on ongoing economic activity. And what happened instead was very severe and detrimental impacts to economic activity. I think about 120,000 businesses a year for a number of years in Canada all went bankrupt, small businesses. And, I just recently went anecdotally to a restaurant over in Vancouver on Powell Street that it was a wonderful little restaurant that finally closed its doors just at the end of January. Popular as they were, because they had accumulated too much debt and couldn't survive the loan repayment schedule was too much and they went bankrupt. So that's what's not supposed to happen with a pandemic response. You're supposed to try and help create a pathway for a healthy economy, so the task force came down heavily critical of the lockdowns, and also the the hysteria going on in the messaging from public health in Alberta, you know, which ended up having consequences like police officers, threatening at the point of tasering a couple of young men or older boys who were playing in the middle of winter. One of them was playing goalie on a pond outdoors in like, you know, minus 20 degree weather. And the other one was shooting, pucks at the goalie with their hockey stick out in the middle of the rink of the pond, you know, and for those that care, never mind, we found out it's not scientific, but the 6 feet apart was never a thing. But even if it was, the two hockey players were well apart, you know, like, you know, 35 feet apart half the time. And yet the police went ahead and, wrestled them to the ground and, you know, told them to stop playing hockey outdoors, you know, basically just for two people. Anyway, things like that were going on. And they also, they came down heavily saying that that there is no science to support the masking. And you know, the wearing of masks does not prevent getting the virus or transmitting the virus. And even on the, you know, it gets really, really goofy when you can go and get, if you go to a warehouse and get a bulk supply of masks, you can even see the sign on the message on the side of the box that says, you know, will not prevent the spread of COVID, but never mind, you know. So and also pointed out in their review that the vaccine, you know, there are real questions around the effectiveness of the vaccine, and especially that healthy children and youth, you know, under the age of 18, should not be receiving this vaccine at all. And they also said that the public health was derelict in their simply disappearing on the whole question of acquired immunity. If somebody had received had COVID and recovered from it, as 99.8% of the people in the world who got it did, that people should respect, natural immunity, you know, is something that's solid. It's been part of scientific medical observation for thousands of years, and how all of a sudden this just disappeared and was sent off the playing field is something to be factored in between a patient and their doctor is a real stain against Alberta Health and of course many other health authorities in Canada and beyond. And they also said that it's clear from lots of literature that hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin certainly have proven abilities to deal with COVID, and that this, you know, this if you know, as an aside, if you go to Merck, which is a chemical medical company based in New Jersey, and you go to their offices, outside of their offices in Kenilworth, New Jersey, there's a plaque, and the plaque talks about how Merck was involved in the development of ivermectin, and which was offered as treatment for several sight diseases affecting a variety of animals in the early 80s. And starting in 1987, they, adjusting the dose, because humans are different than horses, as we know, they would give dosage for human beings as opposed to horses to treat a variety of maladies. And that this resulted in Merck scientist William Campbell sharing the Nobel Prize in Science in Physiology or Medicine for their role in developing. So you can go and look at that plaque outside of Merck, and put up there in 2016, and then all of a sudden you have this propaganda from the media. That goes after a very viable alternative to treating COVID. So this is some of the highlights of that report. Now, I mean, the report is 269 pages long. I'll send you a link that people can read it. A link to the show notes here, and it's very thorough. But you have in response to it, there's some pushback from the regular culprits, like in British Columbia, Dr. Bonnie Henry has come, was interviewed, I think, on CBC, rolling her eyes and saying the vaccine's safe and effective. And I guess that's all she can say, because if all of a sudden she was in a news interview and said, well, actually it wasn't actually safe or effective, I you can just hear the howling and of all the people in the base that wants to believe in almost with religious fervor in the vaccine. So in any event,
Well, they should ask her, can you cite a study that says it is safe? Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
I mean, let's start with that.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's anyway. I think people who listening to this I really recommend that people read through. I've quickly looked through it, but I think it's got it's very solidly argued. I've met one of Dr. David's speaker. I met him and talked to him about the forthcoming report. So I think that, and they knew that they're writing a report that's critical of the quote unquote consensus. And the consensus has been reached by not allowing anyone who disagrees to say anything without being deplatformed. But here we have, I think the significance is that here we have an official report from one of our provinces here in Canada, raising serious questions about the way that that we did things during the pandemic. And I think that that's really good news, because finally, at last, there can be a discussion about what's happened, because there's been a lot of mistakes made, in my view. And I think that what the report from Alberta has to say is worth reflecting on.
All right, very good. Well, thanks for sending that link then along, so that we can actually go through it. I know it was in the news, but not really so complimentary. Like, can you believe what Alberta is doing?
Yeah. Well, it seems that we have lost our way in terms of being able to have a conversation about an important topic in our society, in our democracies. The way of having a conversation now is to just have someone say mockingly, "You're wrong, you're ridiculous," or your mother wears army boots or something, and then it's all about bad mouthing and so on. But the report itself has many hundreds of footnotes and studies that it cites. So I think that people can go to all those links and in the report itself and read all of the studies that they're citing to support their conclusions.
Yeah. Okay. Good. All right then. Well, there's two newsworthy items just worth talking about and bringing up to the people in case they hadn't heard about that.
We keep having important stories that are underreported, so I'm happy to discuss them with you today.
Right. All right, Ray. Thanks so much. Before we wrap up, is there anything else you did want to bring up at all, or is that it for today?
No, I'll keep anything else for later.
All right.
See what develops. Yeah.
Okay, thanks very much, and just keep in contact with me via email, right, or call anytime. And thanks again.
Okay, thanks, Lynn.
Okay, good night, Ray. Okay, this will air Thursday.
Good. I will send you the link to the report, and I'll send you a link to the Canadian Constitution Foundation, because they have a good overview of some of the things I was discussing with you.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, good.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Good night.
Okay. Thanks, Lynn. Yeah. Bye-bye.